Hey everybody, I am Luminous.
And I'm Rico.
And welcome to another episode of the Top Deck Time. This is episode 17. And boy, today we got a sweet, sweet deck list for you guys. But before we get to that, let's welcome my co-host from the fine weathers of Austria. We got Rico.
Hello there.
How's
yeah,
it going?
We had like I'm doing good. I'm on a holiday, basically. I don't have university for another 2 months, so that's amazing.
Sweet.
Yep. And yeah, and enjoying my time.
That's like perfect, right? 2 months later, when perhaps set two is quote unquote dying down a little bit, you can now focus on school again. But right now, we are in the heat of things. Any particular news you want to touch up on before we get into the main topic of the day, which is the horn that we want to talk about?
The one thing worth noting, I think, is the last ETS, it was yesterday.
Sure.
Where I was hoping for a little bit of a bigger impact of set two, but guess it didn't fully hit yet. We have actually very few set two cards in the top eight lists. Most of them are Makoto or Slay, which was expected.
Rakano Plate took number one, and I do believe that at least in the main board, it had no new set two cards. In the sideboard, there was a couple of spirit guides, or one spirit guide. So that's the extent of set two cards. Second place, we had a prime timal monsters list, so a Legion midrange. Same thing there. Main board, just standard set one cards. Sideboard, there was a couple of sand vipers. All right, you know, yeah, pretty good draft cards.
Worth noting that the Legion deck played for Terryx Hatchling. Like, that's not something we saw a lot of, I think.
All right. That's definitely very, very different. Tyrus Hatchling curving right into Sandstorm Titan. Because you
for
know,
the synergy,
let's say the combos. All right.
No, that punishes them for killing the Titan, right?
Oh. Get him if you do, get him if you don't, man. Got him.
Yeah, right. It's a nod to the full force in an obelisk. We've seen some Elysian deck running two or maybe or three maybe, and crystallized. This list isn't running crystallized, but it's running more units and seeing an obelisk.
So, and then as we move down the rankings of the ETS, there were a couple of like new cards, but it's like you said, it's mostly Makoto, right? Most Justice decks are splashing, let's say, Shadow. A lot of the Combray decks splash Shadow. Korthon showed up once, I believe, in a Justice Primal Fire control deck.
I believe there was also a Chalice deck. I think Buckwheat played Chalice with Korthon. And there were actually a couple of Praxis midrange decks.
True.
And there's one in the top 8 as well.
Yeah, Praxis midrange took third. The one thing I do want to say about the whole thing that we don't have a lot of new kind of cards represented, at least in 1 and 2 finishes, is that look at the decks I won, Rakano Plate or Elysian midrange.
Yeah.
The styles is all tried and true. The concept is well tested. Whereas if you're trying to do some sweet Xenon control or, I don't know, Argent Port control or something like that, like, first of all, people might not have acquired all the cards and they don't want to, you know, craft all the cards to try things out. And second, people are still tinkering with the list, right? Rakano Plate has been around for such a long time, but throughout the evolution of Rakano Plate at its early days, the deck changed around drastically, very differently, in fact. In fact, Rakano Plate used to not even have plate. It was just like other Rakano stuff.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me to see ETS being dominated by set one stuff till a while. I know there is a discussion of perhaps set two cards not being as strong as set one cards, and perhaps we could delve into that discussion at a different day, but I think that we just need a little bit more time to see set two cards really, you know, take its reign.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. I wouldn't write this off to power level or not power level alone. I totally agree with you that like there are established decks and people didn't have a lot of time brewing and refining the lists, and like it's not like tournament winning list is built in 1 week, as you said. Rakano had many, many iterations as well.
Looking forward to how the next few weeks shapes up.
Mm-hmm.
Can I talk about personal news, because I'm excited to share?
Absolutely.
All right. So recently I got invited to the International. It's a Dota 2 event. It's the biggest Dota 2 event where I believe the number one team takes a little bit shy of a $10 million prize pool. That's for the number one
Jesus.
Finishing place. So the whole tournament prize pool is, I believe, close to $20 million if we're not up to that point. So I get the privilege of casting the event. It's definitely a huge honor to be invited. I wasn't in the event last couple of years, so being kind of re-invited back into the event is a big jump for myself personally. So I feel very happy with that. In terms for the show, we're going to try our best to actually keep this consistently on a weekly basis. We have not missed a single episode for the Top Deck Time, and I don't intend to miss it, even if I'm casting international.
That's some dedication right there.
Rico is definitely going to pull most of the weight, though, because I'm not sure how often I'll be able to play Eternal as I'm casting Dota, but we got Rico on the show. So
we'll figure worried. It out.
Yeah. Oh, actually, one more thing. I do want to do a little bit of preview for next week. So as we kind of touch up on a lot of these like new legendaries are perhaps not as strong or you don't really know what to craft, I think one topic that we want to touch on next week is the top five legendaries we believe in set two. Some things that you should look to craft or dust, depending what legendaries you have. I think that's always a very interesting topic. In fact, we were going to actually do it for this week, but we wanted a little bit more data point. We don't want to give false information to some of the newer players out there to craft, like, you know, craft some knuckle bones, perhaps. That will be an interesting one that Rico and I would debate heavily over whether to craft or not. But anyways, that is going to be next week's episode. So if you're kind of enjoying for that, you could subscribe us to us on iTunes. We are there, and you could get an instant alert when our new episode is released. But without further ado, we are going to dive into today's deck, which is featured around Shepherd's Horn.
Yes.
The reason that we decided to do a Shepherd's Horn deck, well, it's we didn't actually decide to do it. Last week, we opened up a deck, Doctor, which if you haven't listened to previous episodes of shows, we basically allow listeners to actually submit their decks. You could do it via Reddit, or you could use our email, topdecktime@gmail.com. Send us a list, and then, you know, we look over it to see if it's interesting to build around it. And basically, the list that was sent to us was a standard Elysian mid-range kind of list. Obviously, taking advantage of Shepherd's Horn synergy would overwhelm, and, you know, they kind of build around that. So we'll start with the Elysian list, and then we'll talk about how we kind of evolved the list to what we believe to be the final iteration of the list. But before we get into that, let me read Shepherd's Horn. So it's a 3-power time relic with 1 time requirement. Shepherd Horn, your cards with overwhelm cost 1 less. When you play a card with overwhelm, you gain 3 life.
So when I first saw this, I was actually very interested in this. I think I touched on that in one of our last episodes, that I think that effects that let you quote-unquote cheat on the power system are inherently powerful. So I was actually very interested in playing with this. I wasn't sure whether the 3 life would be super relevant often, but I think we will get into that a little bit later. But that was my first impression.
Yeah, my first impression when I saw the card spoiled, I was like, it's one of those cards where it doesn't really excite you because it's not doing anything too crazy or too new where you haven't seen before. And honestly, it wasn't a card that I was excited to brew with. And I also thought that this card wasn't that good, but as we play with the deck, it felt amazing. It's like, where's my Shepherd's Horn? All I wanted to do was to draw at least one or two Shepherd's Horn. But more on that later. So can you kind of take us through the list that was sent to us and credit the great author that did come up with the original
Luko
list?
Luko One. Yes. Thank you for submitting the list. We sure had a fun week. So let's go through the cards real quick. So, Luko played Copper Conduit. Like pretty much all of his units have overwhelmed. Cult Aspirant. That's the new 1-power, 1/1, 1-time influence requirements. Overwhelm life force. When you gain health, he gets +1/+1. And that synergizes with the horn, because if you have a horn out, you can play it for free and then gain 3 in life, so he immediately becomes a 2/2. Yep. So that's pretty cute. He plays 2 Permafrost, 2 Predator's Instinct, 4 Ambacolite, 4 Dawnwalker, 4 False Prince. So classic Elysian low to the ground units. 3 Shepherd's Horn, 2 Wisdom of the Elders, 4 Sandstorm Titan, 3 Xenon Obelisk for Cersei, 2 Crystallize, and then it gets a little bit spicy with 2 Divining Rod, 2 Plated Goliath, that's the 7-4 Overwhelm
7-5
and 7-5 Overwhelm Warp Dinosaur. Yep. And 2 Talia, who sees beyond. And obviously he has 4 Ember Monument, as well as some Seeds, Banners, Diplo Seals, yeah. So
that's a pretty standard Elysian mid-range list, right? Like, I mean, I think the Cold Aspirin might look a little bit strange comparing to Pass, but this is as standard of Elysian mid-range as you get.
Yep, with one notable exception, he didn't play any Wisps.
Friendly Wisp, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So we took the game, the deck through some games, and we had some problems with it, or at least I did. For me, Divining Rod never really got there. Like, Divining Rod was good when I was in a good position, but not really helping me to catch up on board, because most of the Overwhelm units are a little bit more expensive, so it gets harder to play a unit into a Rod.
Yep.
You could do that with Cult Aspirant at 7, but that still didn't come up very often for me, and all in all, Divining Rod just felt a little bit lacking. So I wanted to remove those.
Also, real fast, Divining Rod also had a very awkward synergy with Copper Conduit. Like, if you flip Copper Conduit off the top, and if you didn't have any power, then it comes into play as a 0/0 Copper Conduit, because it has power surge. So that felt really, really awkward.
Right. And also, I wanted to remove some... I wanted to remove the Talia because of that. I felt like if I'm not cheating them out, it gets a little bit harder to play them.
Sure. But you're cheating it out with Shepherd's Horn. It costs one less.
Right. So that's another thing I wanted to change. Shepherd's Horn was very good for me, actually, in pretty much every game. So I wanted to up it to 4, definitely. Shepherd's Horn is really amazing with Dawnwalker. Because every time you return Dawnwalker, you still play it from your void, so you gain another 3 health. So every Overwhelm unit you then play gives you 6 health. If you have a Dawnwalker in your void.
Let's talk about that aspect of the card, right? Like, because I think the discount is what people talk about a lot. And like you said earlier, when you first look at the card, you don't even remember whether the life gain aspect of Shepherd Horn was relevant or not. So, spoiler alert, it is very relevant. But why did you think it was relevant in the games that you played?
The low drops of the deck aren't super good. So sometimes you fall behind on board a little bit against aggressive Skycrake or Recano draws. And in the games where I had Horn, it just didn't matter. Like, they couldn't kill me. Like, I played a Horn on turn 3. I took some damage and I was below 20. And then I just started slamming Fatty after Fatty, stabilizing the board, stabilizing my life total. And, like, it's so hard to keep up. Like, I had games where I had 2 Horn and a Dawnwalker in my void, we both were on top deck mode, and I just gained 12 life out of nowhere. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, the crazy thing for me is that you could Horn into turn 4, you play 2 Dawnwalkers in the same turn, because they get discounted, right? Instead of costing 3, because they cost 2 each. So you go Horn on turn 3, and then on turn 4, you go Dawnwalker, you gain 6 health. Obviously, the Dawnwalkers are not great at blocking, but in this particular deck, you want to block and trade with them. You want them to end up in the void. And then it goes back to the scenario where you present it. And on turn 5, I don't know, you play another big, dumb, overwhelm unit. Let's say play the Goliath, because it costs 5 now with the Horn down. Both Dawnwalker comes back. You gain 9 health. You know, think of that poor, poor Skycrack aggro player. It's like, oh my god, I'm trying to charge you for 4. You gain line. You got 3 guys on the board, and they're like, okay, well.
Yeah. Or like decks with Flame Blast. Yeah. Against Skycrack aggro, it was so good. So I really love that aspect of the deck. And obviously, like, it's hard to go wrong when you play a deck that plays 4 Sandstorm Titans, so that always feels nice, I think.
The funny thing with Sandstorm Titan this deck is that
he's not even good.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of times where I draw Sandstorm Titans, like, I just...
Why does this guy have Overwhelm?
Yeah, I just wish, like, I had a Horn Vorlunk or something. Maybe that's, like, a little bit of disrespect to Sandstorm Titan, because, you know, Horn Vorlunk is pretty bad. That's a 4 power, 3/4 Overwhelm. But, like, I just kind of wish there's another Overwhelm unit on 4 that's actually good to play. So, it's like, that's crazy to think about. We're saying Sandstorm Titan is not the card that we want to top deck in this deck. That just kind of... You know, frame how
it's
crazy.
It's still good.
It brings back the Dawnwalkers, but
you're overplaying that a little bit, I think. I really like the whole core of the Horn here. A problem that I ran in with most deletion decks is that I think it has very little staying power. As in, yes, you can drop some fatties, but once both players get into a top deck war, it's it can get a little bit awkward, or you don't have any reach as well. So once, like, your control opponent can stabilize, if you either haven't drawn enough Dawnwalkers or they can could summon Silence, that it gets a little bit hard to win, because, like, you have no real late game engine or no reach.
Yep.
And another thing I noticed is that the Cult Aspirants, they weren't great because they were only good with Horn, but the games with Horn felt amazing already.
They were there mostly, it felt like, as a one power overwhelm unit. Mm-hmm. And like the whole, like the fact that it could grow bigger, we are not really taking advantage of it. So would you play a one power 1/1 overwhelm? Probably not.
Yeah. No.
The other thing about the matchup against the control unit is that the Horn in itself doesn't really help you, because mm-hmm. you're fighting, like, the whole life gain aspect, you're not fighting the same axis against, like, control deck. Control decks are fighting you versus card advantage, right? So your life total just doesn't matter. The whole discount aspect helps a little bit, but most control games do tend to go long. Like, you're not going to have trouble casting your cards. And against control matchup, it really came down to card velocity, whether you have enough reach to kill them when you get them low, whether you have enough refill if, you know, they blow up your board once or twice. And I just felt the card Shepherd's Horn, at least with this shell of the Legion midrange list, had a pretty bad matchup against control lists, especially when they are not control lists that rely on combat, right? Like, combat, Cirsto is still, like, pretty king there. But against certain lists where, yeah, we're going to just harsh rule a couple times, we're going to kill you with things like Channel the Tempest, then you feel pretty dumb playing, you know, Sandstorm Titan and Cirsto, because they just, you're not interacting with the same axis. And this is where I personally had issue with this list, where you had two Wisdom of the Elders as quote-unquote card advantage. And I guess Divining Rod or Plate of Goliath, these are not the card advantage you could really rely upon. So whenever games went beyond turn 8, 9, or 10, I just felt like I lost. Like, there's no way I could win with this list.
So yeah, and on the side, like, I didn't only play this deck, I tried going full Workshop Forge. I tried building the mono warp deck with Stone Shakers and Workshop Forge, and like all of the warp cards, even like the really bad ones, like
alongside Shepherd's Horn.
No. I was playing the Legion deck. I was trying it out, but I was also working on this deck, which I wouldn't ever recommend using in ranked. I mean, like, I did, but I made good use of the 5 games that you can lose without dropping a rank. So, and then I started playing real decks again. But what I realized is that warp is a pretty great mechanic for decks that go a little bit later. And it feels really, really good to play, like, the 7/5 overwhelm off the top of your deck, or the Heart of the Vault, or even Shatterglass Mage. I was very impressed by that guy. And then, like, something clicked and I was like, okay, why not play Horn in a Praxis deck and make a real deck out of those?
So then we switched.
To Praxis, yeah.
We basically took apart the deck, which, I guess, sorry, Lugo. We definitely did try the list on the Legion, but we just felt like something just felt a little bit wrong. Something felt missing, right? So we swapped to Praxis instead. We put Horn. And what are some of the all-star units that did it for you in the list? You talked about Plated Goliath and Shatterglass Mage.
Yeah, Plated Goliath and Shatterglass Mage, both as a 4-of. I think they are amazing in this deck. Once you reduce the cost of your warp cards, it becomes really feasible to warp them. With cards like Plated Goliath and Shatterglass Mage, if you're not playing against relics, they are... And the Ember Monuments, they're really replaceable, so you don't mind if you don't if you can't play like your Titan as much and play a 4-power Shatterglass Mage instead, and then it just drew your card. And that was one of the downsides I talked about when discussing warp cards, and it doesn't really apply here because, like, you want to be playing all of those on curve anyways.
I think the fact that the Horn discounts it by one is so big. Because the downside of warp is that you're paying some sort of inherent cost to have the text warp on the card. Mm-hmm. But if it's very expensive, let's say the 6-cost Plated Goliath or the 5-cost Shatterglass Mage, then, you know, half the time you can't actually cast it because you're drawing it on turn four or whatever. But if you have a horn down, or by God, two horns, there were actually times where I thought I was playing a warp deck, you know, when I was just casting stuff off the top. Now, that's not the focus, but the fact that it helps with the horn aspect really, really synergizes really well with the rest of the deck. And of course, both Plate of Goliath as well as Shadowglass Mage brings back your Dawnwalker, which is actually very critical for the deck. So I remember when we first looked at Plate of Goliath, it's like, good draft card. We're not going to play in Constructed.
Yeah, I super underrated this guy. He has impressed me. And 7-5 is no joke. 7-5 is no joke.
When you could cast it for 5 or 4, 7-5 is...
But even for 6 is fine.
If you can warp it, yeah. Like, I'm not too excited casting it from my hand, but, you know.
Yeah, although even that isn't the absolute worst. Like, playing him for 6 from your hand obviously isn't great, but in this deck, I still feel he's pulling a lot of weight, even if you do it that way.
For sure, for sure.
Just because a lot of your units have Overwhelm, every additional power you can get on the board will deal damage to your opponent at some point, because they have only so much, like, defense. It's putting 7 power worth of Overwhelm onto the board is still very good, I think. We are also, aside from playing the Goliath and Shatterglass Mage, by the way, Shatterglass Mage, we started as a 2-off, I think, and we just kept upping them because they felt amazing. Not only because we were running in a couple of attachments, but just being able to play an Overwhelm unit off the top of your deck in this deck is so much additional value with the Dawnwalkers and the Shepherd Horns.
Also, Shatterglass Mage has the best entrance sound. She goes, I just renamed my deck to Horn. Because, like, every time, like, we don't even call Shatterglass Mage by her name anymore.
Which is,
it's like, what do I want a top deck next turn? Yeah, we need a Yah right here. We need a Yah, because they have probably some dumb relic.
Yeah, we had like a 5-hour Skype session where we just played the decks and brewed. It was so much fun. He has an attachment. Let's Yah it.
Yes. All right. So Shatterglass Mage, I only have one crafted. I was like, yep, we're going to full four. And I think they were all premium because, you know, why not? Yeah, I mean, anyways, so you were talking about other cards.
Heart of the Vault. Here we go. Had to throw it out there. Okay, so there are cards that look good during spoiler season and they disappoint a little. And there are cards that look bad in spoiler season and they are a little bit better than you thought. And then there's Heart of the Vault, who looks amazing. Everyone said he's amazing and he is absolutely amazing.
But he doesn't have Overwhelm. Why are we having him in the deck?
He doesn't, because it's just such a powerful card. Maybe we have some new listeners. The Heart of the Vault is a 6-power 6/6 with 3 fire and 3 time influence. He has warp. And on summon, he deals 2 damage to an enemy, and you draw a card and reduce its cost by 2. And that is a lot of text for a 6/6. He's like everything you want to be doing. Like, he gives you reach, he gives you a little bit of board control, he returns your Dawnwalkers, and he generates card advantage potentially twice, once you warp him and once when you draw the card. So this is... he's doing everything.
I think the big difference that between the so far the practice list we talked about and the Legion list that was sent to us by Luka1 is that if you want to refill in a Legion deck, you have to take the turn off playing Wisdom of the Elders or maybe setting up a Friendly Wisp to try to trigger off things like Cirso or Sandstorm Titan. But the difference of using card advantage this way with warp is that you are casting a 7-5 or casting a 6-6 and you're drawing a card right then and there. So you're not giving up anything. You're playing a big dumb dude, you're drawing a card. So if they deal with that, okay, up next, you're playing another big dumb dude, you're quote-unquote drawing a card. Now, sometimes you're not drawing off the card because warp is not guaranteed, but it felt like it gave us a little bit more oomph in the longer matchups.
More staying power, definitely. Yeah. Let's come to the sleeper, I'd say.
The sleeper. All right. So let me kind of preface it a little bit. So Shepherd's Horn, it says your cards with Overwhelm cost 1 less. Now everyone's mind jumps to the fact that, hey, yeah, you know, we play units with Overwhelm, but it says your cards with Overwhelm cost 1 less. It never said your units with Overwhelm cost 1 less. So there are some cards that has a text Overwhelm on them that you could play, namely Obliterate and also Stonescar Maul, weapon that has Overwhelm, and the spell that has Overwhelm. Those cards also get reduced, and yes, those cards also get life game when you play it.
Yes.
It is the cheesiest feeling when you obliterate them for lethal as you gain 6 health. You know, why not? You know, why not?
Yeah, and honestly, like, playing an obliterate for 4 just feels dirty. And against aggressive decks, you're playing your removal spell for 4, and you're gaining 3 health back. That's just super good.
What? That's insane. Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. I love it. And yeah, once you get multiple horns going, like, this deck goes off, quote unquote, because you can, as Lumi said, chain the warp units and, like, play a Sandstorm Titan and an obliterate in the same turn. And, like, it's really, really cool. And with Stone Scum All, there's something very interesting. See, Stone Scum All has Overwhelm, and thus it grants all your spells in your hand Overwhelm. Now, yes. When you have a Shepherd Horn, that means all of your spells get one cheaper now. So you can go, like, turn three Horn, turn 4 something, turn 5 Stone Scum All into Torch, for example.
Sure.
Or Stone Scum All Predator's Instinct.
That Torch is free?
And the Torch is overwhelming.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. It gains you 3 health.
It's a free Lightning Helix.
Actually, better than Lightning Helix, because any residual damage splashes to the face.
Yeah.
So, yeah. To be fair, I only pulled that off once, but the game that I pulled it off, I was actually behind, where I played Heart of the Vault on the previous turn. The card I drew was Seek the Way, or Find the Way. Mm-hmm. So it echoed 2 copies of Find the Way, which cost 0, because that's what Heart of the Vault does. And I was at like 2 life. I had 2 horns down. Next turn, I slammed down Stone Scar Maul. I go, find the way, seek power.
So that's... Gain 18.
Absurd amount of life. My opponent was like,
what?
You gotta be kidding me.
So, that's amazing.
Now, that's not the combo we're actually going for, but holy goddamn, that is crazy. That's insane.
One that I like that we decided to play as a one-off in the Praxis deck that stood out for me was Purify. Yeah, it's the 3 power, 1 time, 1 fire, fast spell. Silence a unit and deal 3 damage to it. So 3 power for 3 damage is a very bad rate, I think, for a removal spell. And that's a bit of a problem. However, the silence is very good. It's sometimes a little bit awkward when you want to, like, silence a Seraph or a Steward, and you can't really kill it with Purify if you don't get into combat first. But having access to a silence main deck seemed pretty strong to me, and it might be correct to run more than one.
Yep.
Because the one thing that this deck is really bad against is it can deal with threats. It has like Predator's Instinct, Torch, and Obliterate. But it doesn't have a ton of removal, and all of its removal is conditional.
Yes.
So, for example, if your opponent ever gets, like, an 8-8 Mystic Ascendant, it Good is luck. Very hard for this deck to deal with.
You have to do some awkward attacks. You have to, like, help them they block. You have to do enough damage, and you're like, okay, I got you with Obliterate afterwards. But, you know, if they don't block, you just don't have any hard removal.
Yeah, if they don't block, you're like your only chance, like, your only hope is that you have dealt enough damage before and can sort of try to go around the Mystic Ascendant or try to burn him out, and that's a little bit of a problem. So that's where silence effects can really help.
Yeah. The one card that I thought about playing or was interested to try out is Arcanum Monitor. Now, Arcanum Monitor does have the text Overwhelm on it, but traditionally he's much more powerful in a deck where you're playing Grenadine Drones or Assembly Lines, where you're actively trying to go wide. But the extra power and toughness for your whole team is sort of relevant, especially for Dawnwalkers. I think it's pretty decent. Never gotten around to try it out because we evolved the Praxis Horn deck into a different version. So there's a couple of things that we solved, right? We have reach now. Obliterate is very, very good. We have more staying power thanks to the warp aspect of the cards. But we still lack something. Like, we still lack the ability to deal with some big units, especially when they are not getting into combat with us. This deck felt really bad if you are falling behind against really big units, because you're playing 7/5s. That's pretty big. But if they just have a 10/10 or 8/8, then...
Oh yeah, that was another one, Cersei, right? Like, we played against the Cersei once, and we were like, okay.
We actually can't beat Cersei.
Yeah, like, he had an obelisk out, and it was 7/7, and we were like, all right, I guess good game.
So, like, we just had difficulty beating very problematic units. Like, we just can't beat a Mokdo, I felt like. Like, sure, we could kill the Mokdo, no problem. But then it just kept coming back.
I honestly felt that Mokdo wasn't too much of a problem for the deck just because it can deal so much damage with and like, can flood the board with such large units. I felt like Mokdo was okay, but, like, Sursa and Mystic Ascendant that was too large were kind of a problem. Like, it's not like we've been running into them a lot. We've mostly actually ran in, I think the deck we played most against was the Skycrake aggro.
Yeah, we beat them, like, pretty much every time. Or close to every time. Right after that game with the Sursa that we lost to, we're like, okay, this Praxis list is sweet, but I don't think this Praxis list is it. We could still make this list a little bit better. What also was happening as we were going up to losing against that the 6-6 overwhelm that the name just escaped me, Sursa, was that I was flooding so hard. I was like Noah's Ark kind of flooding. It was crazy. I was drawing sigils after sigils after sigils. I was like, you know what? If I'm going to flood as hard, let's add a little bit more late game insurance. So I was thinking, what's something that gives me late game insurance and also help us tackle some problematic creatures or units? So I was like, okay, let's add Justice, because Justice gives us 4 Seraph. So if it does get to 8, that is a good game plan. And Seraph is a fine unit to play, has Overwhelm, blocks good early, helps you stabilize and stuff like that. And it gets you Desert Marshal, which is a godsend with this deck. Like, it just like fills the rest of the big hole that this deck needed. It lets you play so much better against those big problematic units. Yeah, sure, there's still A8s. You still have to find a way to deal with it, but they're not drawing a single card every turn.
But it also lets you play way better against aggressive decks. Like, having an additional early drop is super good.
Being able to silence only Ronins or challenging their Champion of Fury, so important. I think with the addition of Desert Marshal, our game against Skycrack aggro just went that much better. Like, it was already decent before, but now it was just great. Are those the only 2 Justice cards that we added to the list, or was there more?
We tried a couple of Copperhole elites at first, but being a 4-power 4-4 just didn't really cut it for us. So we parted ways, and we ended up with only 8 Justice cards, actually.
Even though we only added 8 Justice cards, we had to take more out of the original Praxis list, because in order to fit these 8 cards in, we had to up some number of Find the Ways.
Yeah, the Praxis version didn't run any Find the Ways, actually.
Yeah, you're playing a fully 3-faction deck where you're trying to cast Heart of the Vault on 6, right? So like, the mana or the sigil base is a little bit greedy. I am actually toying with adding a couple of Vanquishes into the list, because that does deal with the issue that we're, again, so struggling with, which is the big dumb new. The final list, as always, will be on topdecktime.wordpress.com, but I'm going to quickly read that out. We got 2 Predatorous Instinct, 3 Seek Power, 4 Desert Marshal, 2 Find a Way, 4 Temple Scribes, 4 Dawnwalkers, 4 Seraph, 4 Shepherd's Horn, 4 Sandstorm Titan, 4 Obliterate, 4 Shattered Glass Mage, 4 Heart of the Vault, 4 Plate of Goliath, and then we have 2 slots that were not really like knowing what to do. At its place, we had a couple of Stone Scars Mauler. I even went up to the 9 drop, the Goliath that shoots an Obliterate out when you play it. That was interesting for a while. I currently have, you know, a couple of Mystic Ascendants in there because it's Mystic Ascendant. But Vanquish might be a card that I'm trying out next. And of course, the sigil base, we include 4 Ember Monument because it's Ember Monuments. Yeah.
Ember Monument is actually very important to all of those decks, I think.
Yes.
Like, it just giving you the additional Overwhelm unit, the additional 5-power unit for your Dawnwalkers.
For sure.
It's way more important than I hoped it would be.
So I am happy to say that we actually ranked up to Masters with this list. It was a little bit of a struggle.
You
Well, you were helping me, so yeah, we did. Like, it was really of a struggle when we were going up from Diamond 1 to like 2 Masters. We did it. We got there. So
this was a lot of fun and a lot of yeah involved.
There was a lot of yeah involved, yeah, for sure. So I think the list is definitely powerful. I wouldn't say it's like the next thing, like Tier 1, oh my god, amazing. But
no.
It definitely exceeded my expectation. Like, when I first saw the list like involving Shepherd's Horn, I was like, okay, this is going to be meme, right? If it wins, it's, you know, whatever, it's going to be the few games that it does win, but this is an okay ladder deck, I would say for sure. Like, it's definitely a very strong deck, and more importantly, a hell of a fun deck to play, because there's no better feeling when you're warping cards after cards after cards with the deck.
For sure, and I think it was a very fun week, because all of the decks we've gone through, I enjoyed very much playing, and I think it was interesting to, like, build and evolve a deck again, finally. Like, I felt like I tried everything with set one, and now there's so much more room to explore new stuff, and I just love it. I had a ton of fun.
There were a couple points where I was worried that, you know, you have all of these new cards, and I could clearly say, okay, this card would improve this current existing deck. By the way, Reforge in Armory apparently is the bee's knees, right? So yeah, supposedly this deck has really, really good matchup against Armory, because all you're doing is playing huge dumb dudes.
You're essentially playing four Dawnwalker,
yeah,
a lot of huge dudes, and four Shatterglass Mage.
And we were struggling against Armory because they kept reforging things, and they were just hitting it in our face for like 12 at a time. We're like, oh my god. I do believe we are still like advantage versus Armory. But
I mean, Reforge is deck list.
Yeah, Reforge is great. So like we saw a lot of these individual cards that could make pre-existing archetype great, but we were just struggling to find some like set two decks, exclusive set two decks. We're like, oh god, great. We can now build this and play with that. So I was getting a little bit disappointed, but this particular list, like, gave me hope. Show me the light. It's like, okay, yeah, you know, there are some new stuff that if you look deep enough and try hard enough, you will find. And that's why I'm not too worried with the, like I said earlier, with the ETS results. It's like, yeah, right now set one is dominating, but give it a month or two, you know, people are going to find new cool things.
Definitely. Oh man, and like the mono warp deck, it isn't good, but I was literally laughing at my screen. I was just playing the gauntlet, and fair warning, I didn't beat it, and I tried several times, but it's just so much fun.
Yeah.
No, I think there's a lot of things still out there. The Rakano decks, they didn't play for so long, and like there's so much that we don't know after like 2 weeks.
Sure. I mean, even for a deck like Rakano Play, I'm sure Unearthly, the guy who championed the deck originally, I'm sure he could still, like, he's still tinkering with it and toying with it.
For sure.
Yeah. Not with the card Tinker, because that card is not so good, but you guys know what I mean. So before we actually go into some of the other cool lists we played this week, I do want to give another shout out to Luka1, who did send us this list. And I think the Deck Doctor, I guess, series is still open. At least I'm open to having more decks sent to us. Is that true, Rico?
Absolutely. If you have anything that you think is worth sharing, we would love to take a look at it. Like, we might not be able to do every one of the decks you submit. Like, there was a Skycrack deck submitted as well that we decided on not doing because we talked about Skycrack on the last episode. But like, if you want to share a list, feel free to do so. We love looking at them. We love toying around with decks, as you might know from our previous episodes. So feel free to do so.
And you could reach us on topdecktime@gmail.com, or you could just post a comment on one of the threads that I post on Reddit. We do read them very, very frequently and very consistently. We're going to just use the remainder of maybe 10, 20 minutes of the podcast to talk about some of the other cool lists that we tried and perhaps failed with. Is there any particular list that you want to talk about? Because if not, I want to start with my Exodia combo deck.
That was super fun as well. Yeah. Let's talk about that.
So I actually posted this on Reddit. So you know what? I'm just gonna read the description I wrote of it on Reddit, because I think whatever I say now will not be as good as what I wrote. So it's called Stone Scar Excavator Exodia Combo. This deck took me from Diamond 1 to Diamond 2 with a 1-3 record, but I made it to round 6 of Gauntlet, failing short due to some very insane unlucky draws. Plebs activate Stone Scar Excavator for 1 damage, then 2, then 3. But this deck employs the constructive all-star, Sporefolk, to discard 5 sigils from our deck, so we could begin obliterating our opponents with activations of at least 5 or higher. Whispering Wind and Torgov are the right and left arms of Exodia, because damn, they are needed to find the right pieces. The left leg, Privilege of the Ranks, serves as extra ammo to keep on obliterating the poor opponents. while the right leg's sabotage kicked them in the nuts, or whatever female equivalent, to strip away any fun police removal that they may have to foil our plans. I read like maybe 5 or 6 car names. I'm pretty sure none of them are actually ever played in top constructive decks. Yes. So let me quickly read what the cards actually do, because it is important to... By the way, this is a 50 power deck. And we did have an episode previously talking about 50 power decks, but Rico, why don't you quickly talk about what are some reasons why you want to play a 50 power deck as opposed to a 25 power deck?
Okay, so the first reason to do this is once you have 50 power in your deck and only 25 spells, you can sort of abuse the redraw rule of Eternal. A redraw grants you 2 to 4 sigils, and the rest are spells. So of those spells, you're way more likely to get to your key cards if you have less spells overall, of course. So when trying to build like a combo deck or a deck that is centered around the key card, it makes sense, kind of, to abuse this role to ensure that you have it in your opening hand. And yep. Like with this deck, we looked at Stone Sky Excavator, and Lumi, would you read it for a second?
Sure. It's a 3-power relic with 1 fire requirement. It says Stone Sky Excavator. Once per turn, you may pay 4 and discard a power card to deal 1 damage to the enemy for each power card in your void. So I think how this card is quote-unquote supposed to be played is you pay 4 to activate it for 1 damage to the face. And then next turn, you do it again for 2 damage. And then 3, and then 4, and eventually kill them. But that's just too slow, right? Like you gotta do some work beforehand to actually start doming them for 7, 8, or 9.
So I think that's another good reason to play 50 land in this deck, 50 power cards in your deck. Like this card asks you to discard power cards, so you want to have enough fuel to shoot the opponent. And
Right. Yeah,
we were looking at the card and we were like, okay, this is interesting. This gives you another angle to win the game, quote unquote.
Yep.
And yeah, so what this deck is trying to do is dump as much power into the void as possible early on, and it does so by Sporefulking one of your 50 powers, hopefully, or more, and playing Whispering Wind and Torg of Two, discard those power cards. It's playing Privilege of Rank to refill power cards once you discard it with either of the 3 cards mentioned, and then it just like tries to shoot them before they kill you. So
I think originally we didn't actually start with the Spore folks. Like I don't know, I don't remember what
we started with a non 50 power. We wanted to make it work like in a control shell as
control
a
deck.
As a finisher.
Yeah,
yeah, which is a horrible idea because it takes you so long to shoot them if you're playing this in a fair way. And right. In the control deck, you want to have a finisher that really like can close out a game fast if you got ahead, and this doesn't do it. So yeah, we quickly ended up on the 50 power version. And so, yeah, we didn't have Spore Focus at first. We were like only Fire, Primal, and Justice at first.
I think we were playing something like Courier. Like, oh yeah, you could, find 2 sigils, discard 1, and draw 1. Great! And then we're playing things like Hero Songs. Like, okay, you could draw and discard some sigils. It's just like, look, if you're going to try to meme somebody, you're going to try to kill somebody fast, Hero Song and Quarry are just not fast enough. So we're like, okay, Spore Folk, if you're playing 50 power, there's a good chance off the top. I think, like, on average, you go from 3 to 4, sometimes 4 to 5 even. Sigils discarded off the top. You're playing 50 power.
3 to 4.
Yeah, so it's pretty decent with Spore Folk. In fact, I wanted to get crazy to play Mirror Image. I wanted to Mirror Image my Spore Folk.
Yeah.
And in the beginning,
did work out great.
we did try it. There was one game where the first time we activated Stone Scar Excavator, we activated for like 12.
Yeah.
It was actually freaking insane.
Yeah, it was actually 12, 13 done.
Yeah. But this is already a very inconsistent deck. You're playing 50 powers. And just adding another wrinkle where you already need Spore Folk. And then you need Mirror Image. It was just like really rough. As always, if you're playing a 50 power deck, the MVP of the deck is always Whispering Wind. Because you're trying to kind of find key pieces, like whether it's a Spore Folk or whether you need more Stone Scar Excavator or if you just want to find that harsh rule, Whispering Wind gets you there. So you have nothing but power to discard. And if you have multiple Whispering Winds, you could discard with the first Whispering Wind, you find a card, and if you don't like it, you could discard it again to the second Whispering Wind to kind of chain up the power ranks as you were to find a card that you actually need. I feel like we're spending way too much time to talk about a deck that's terrible, but let me tell you, we had a ton of fun playing Stonescar Excavator as one of the most meme decks ever.
It's bad, all right, but we had a lot of fun on Skype, man.
Yeah.
It was a fun week, gotta say.
It was a good gauntlet machine. It's not good for winning against Gauntlet, but it's really fun to like, I got you, Stonescar Excavator. What's the biggest one we ever hit?
15? It was 16.
16? Okay.
16, yeah.
That was aight.
It was aight.
So I had fun with that one. Is there any other deck that you want to share?
I just wanted to talk really quick about Torgoth again.
Okay,
the Ice Cap Trader. You know, I mean, not only can he sell snow to a Yeti and frequently does so, I actually think the card is very, very good. Like, it was good in this deck, in the Excavator deck, because, like, we were just throwing cards in our Void. And we, like, he eventually grew to a 7/8 there sometimes.
Do you want to read it out real fast?
It's a 4 power, 2 primal influence requirement, 4/5, and when Torgoth hits the enemy player, draw a card, then discard a card, and he has +3/+3 while you have 15 or more cards in your Void.
Right.
So yeah, and we used it in this deck to just draw and discard sigils, basically. But I tried him out in a little bit of an aggressive Felon Shell, where I just use him to chain removal spells to get him through, or like discard the removal spells against control decks. He's just like, I replaced basically the Impending Dooms that I previously played in the aggressive Felon decks, and I've been very, very happy. So I think there's a lot of potential in this card. If some of the listeners want to give that a try, I would highly recommend doing so.
Yeah, when we first talked about the card when it was first spoiled, I kind of was thinking that if this wasn't a 4 power 7/8, then I wouldn't be interested in playing it, because, you know, I'd rather play things like Sandstorm Titan or Impending Doom or whatever have you, right? Like, they're just more impactful 4-drops. It just happened so that the first half of the card, the fact that you could draw and then discard, kind of fulfill a very unique role that not any other unit could fulfill, right? Like, if you want to play a beefy unit, I had this guy in my reanimator list, right? If I'm looking to discard Vara and then to Grasping of Shadow back on turn 5, yeah, I could play things like Hero Song or Whispering Wind, but sometimes it is nice to have a 4/5 that could attack and block.
Definitely.
That actually,
the body isn't irrelevant.
That actually helps out your game plan. And now, instead of thinking, playing this like, oh, I have to get this a 4 power 7/8, I'm thinking more of like, okay, this is a 4 power 4/5 that helps me draw and discard, and if it gets a 7/8, great. If it doesn't get there, he's not in there to be a 7/8. He's in here to forward my game plan. So, hey, yeah. It turns out that when you get to play with the card, you learn more about the card. Instead of, you know, us sitting up in our ivory tower and be like, yeah, we know everything about our turn. We looked at the spoilers. We know everything. It's fine.
And in the Felon deck, he's the top of my curve, except for 2 Lurking Sanguine that I cheat into play with Whispering Wind.
Okay, cool.
So I can just discard any power in excess of 4 and just keep on playing cards. So it's super good. I think if your curve tops at 4, 5, maybe even 6, Torgoth can help your velocity a lot.
The funny thing is that in my reanimator list, Torgoth is at the bottom of my curve.
Yeah, I know.
Unit starts at 4, and then I'm, you know, trying to get Varas or Varax or whatever crazy, you know, legendary out. So, yeah, that was an interesting guy. If you don't have another list, I do want to talk about Knuckle Bones a little bit.
Yes.
Let me read it out. It's a 7-power legendary relic with 1 Skycrag requirement. It reads, summon, transform each card in your deck into a random card. At the start of your turn, draw an additional card. So when we both looked at the card, well, we both kind of came to the conclusion of, oh, we're playing 7 power for a do nothing. and then we transform our deck into a random cards. And in that episode where we talked about, like, was it Mercenary? Veteran Mercenary, where you draw a random card from the faction. It's like, well, random cards are generally very bad, right? Like, you know, you'd rather put a Sandstorm Titan in your deck instead of drawing a random time card, for example. This particular card, it also reads, at the start of your turn, draw an additional card. So, yes, you're drawing a random card, but you're drawing two random cards. And the other big important part about this deck is that it transforms each card in your deck into a random card, including the sigils. So once you hit 7 or 8 power, you're generally done with the powers, essentially, of your deck. And you just rather draw gas, as it were, for the rest of the game. And Knuckle Bones help you to do that. So after realizing that, and I gotta say, I watched Lights Out Ace post a video on Knuckle Bones, and I watched him play it, and I was like, okay, this is pretty interesting. Rico remains unconvinced, but I took the initiative and like tried it out, and I think it's the real deal. Now, I'm not sure, I don't think this is like a tier one constructed finisher, but I think it's definitely worth exploring.
Yeah, I initially underrated the card, for sure.
Yeah. Do you still think it's bad, or do you actually want to play it now?
I think it's okay. I think it's fun because, like, I like the new challenges it poses. Sure. Like, you have to really, like, somebody said that it's bad because it reduces skill because you can't, like, plan out with or against the deck anymore. Mm-hmm. You can't use your plans, but I would argue that the exact opposite is the case. I would argue that it increases the skill required to win the game because you are thrown into super random situations. Like you're drawing, as it says on the card, random cards. So you find yourself in situations that you haven't been in before. Like, yeah, sure, everybody like played against Rakano 1,000 times, so they know what to do with or against the deck. But like against Knuckle Bones, neither the pilot nor the one playing against it knows what to do against the deck once the Knuckle Bone hit. So I think that's very interesting. I also think that the effect is very strong. Like I have to be honest, I forgot that your sigils will transform too. So this gives you a lot of gas. So you can't flood out with this in play. You're just going to draw spells for pretty much the entire game. Sure, you can draw some banners and I think seats. I'm not sure about seats.
Yes, you can draw banners and seats. Yes.
Yeah, and Diplo, but that's very, very unlikely, so you will not flood out. What I want to mention, though, is that the counterplay to this card is so strong. Like, if a player plays Knuckle Bones and then gets it destroyed, all his deck
is filled with
jank, and you just, like, you can't keep up by drawing one card a turn. Like, you can't. So I think it makes for some very interesting games, and I think the card is very strong as well. I just think that it will never be a tier 1 deck, because like once it gets a little bit stronger, people are going to play more Relicate. And for like sure. We are already playing 4 of the... Yeah! Already, so... I don't know. I think it's cool, and I love the card design. I really enjoy the games as well. Like, you had some fun games when I started spectating you when you played the deck, for sure.
So,
and I certainly will try the deck out. I just don't think it will ever be tier 1 due to the major, major drawback this card poses. So.
Contrary to the negativity that is posed on Knuckle Bones, it's not an auto win when you play Knuckle Bone on 7.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Every time Rico spectates me playing Knuckle Bone, I have Knuckle Bone in play. I'm just getting my face bashed in by whatever they have on the board. Because that's not just the problem. You're not just playing a 7 power do nothing. You're playing a 7 power do nothing, and you have to live long enough, let's say 5-6 turns, to actually have Knuckle Bones to, like, you know,
create
that's
value.
That's a lot of hoops you gotta jump through.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like, I even spectated one game where you had 2 out and you just couldn't win, and you decked. Because, like, the card you get, you might not get enough win conditions. And one other problem is you are very unlikely to hit the removal you need. Like, if your opponent does something powerful as well, it's very hard for you to interact with that. Because, like, normal constructed decks, they play a bunch of removal or silence or what have you. But, like, when you draw random cards, there's not that much removal when you look at the number of total cards in the tournament.
You don't know how happy I was drawing things like Rebuke or dispel. Like, these are not even sometimes playable in draft, but like you said, you just don't get removal. So what I've learned that as I kind of experiment more versions with the deck, Lights Out Ace first started with a straight up Skycrack, because, you know, it's a Skycrack card. I then moved over to Skycrack adding Shadow, because Shadow gives you Quarry to dig further. It adds you Annihilate, Store of the Past, like good defensive units. I even play Black Sky Harbinger because, you know, helps you gain life and stabilize.
Yeah.
And I think that cool kids are currently now pairing with Chalice. So you still have the Chalice game plan, playing it with 2/5s, making 4/7s. And if you happen to have Knucklebone drawn into you, you know, the Chalice itself still being on the field says, look, if I'm going to draw a random stranger, it's normally a dead card, but here it helps me draw more cards and it makes a 4/4. So I think the Chalice version might even be much better than whatever version I was playing.
I am not sure it is, though. Like, I think Chalice is fine without Knucklebones. Like, Chalice certainly doesn't need Knucklebones to win.
I'm not saying the Knucklebone makes a deck better, but I think the Chalice shell is better than the current shell that I have, because Chalice is a stronger shell.
Okay.
So the crazy story is, I was playing a Knucklebone mirror. I was on my Skycrack plus Shadow version against Neon Blonde. You might know him working with RNG Eternal. He also runs an amazing podcast. And he was on the Chalice show. And let me tell you, he was outgrinding the bejesus out of me. This was like 10 turns after we both had Knucklebones. And we're just... it could not be true when you said that was one of the most skill testing games that I played. Because, you know, we're just trying to inch out every tiny bit of value that was possible. Like, we're trying to trade up our 2/2 into the 3/2, that kind of stuff. Like, it was absolutely crazy. Unfortunately, the game crashed for whatever reason. He went to annihilate one of my guys, and my game just broke. But eventually, after the game, I told him, oh, sorry, my game crashed. I don't know why. He told me that he still had, like, Harsh Rules in his hand, because he played Harsh Rule in his shell of Chalice. And I was like, okay, there was no way I was going to win that game. But that was, before the game crashed, one of the most enjoyable games I play with Knucklebones, because it's so important to not only cast Knucklebone 7, but also scope out the right hand to cast Knucklebone. Caleb's Choice was big for me. Holding Annihilate was big for me. Holding Permafrost was big for me. I had even like Black Sky plus Withering Witch combo in hand in some of those times, just to make sure that was my Harsh Rule, just to stabilize. And then after the Knucklebones, not only holding the removal, it was like knowing what to do to draw with the cards. Like, hey, if I draw a 2/2 stranger, it's not a trash card. It's a 2/2 that I could attack and block with. It is some of the most unique games of Eternal. I couldn't tell if I was playing draft or constructed, but it felt fun. It felt fun playing it. That's all I got to say. I think we said perhaps a little bit too much, because I want to save a little bit for next week when we do discuss if Knucklebone is whether one of the top 5 legendaries you should craft or dust. But that's going to have to wait for the next week's episode. Hey, the setup's good.
I like it.
So I do believe we are nearing the end of this episode. Any kind of quick thoughts or final words, or any particular cards that you want to talk about that we haven't got to?
I wanted to give a quick shout out to TixieJ. I ran into him on Ladder playing the Greenhorn deck, and he added me after the game, and he turns out he's a listener, so if you're listening, I hope you enjoyed the episode.
Cool. Oh, dude, I played the Justice Horn mirror. I told you about this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually played a mirror, and we could not kill each other because we both had like 2 horns down, and Dawnwalkers are recurring. So we actually sat there rolling Seraph Ultimates for about 20 turns straight. And that still wasn't big enough to actually go through to win the game. What actually ended up happening is that I tricked my opponent into like playing too much Find the Ways. Because I had Find the Ways in my hand. I had cards that I could warp off the top of my deck, but I didn't warp them. Like, I just drew them. Because I knew that the game, it looked like it was going to deck, and it did. So my opponent realized, like, when he was at like 15 cards, like, oh shoot, he was going to deck. And then he just like conceded. That was also one of the most unique games of Eternal play, but not necessarily the most enjoyable one, but oh my god, the horror mirror was insane.
Yeah, it's like honestly, it's I have been in the triple digits of life with this deck on several occasions.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, that is gonna do it with this episode of the Top Deck Time. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Again, a shout out to Luco one for delivering us the original horn list. And of course, if you guys got more deck lists that you want us to check out, you could send it up to us at topdecktime@gmail.com. There you go. And that's it. Our intro and concluding music is Monolith by the Fat Rat. And I hope you guys had a good one. I am Luminous, and joining me has always been Rico.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. We will see you next week. Bye, guys.
Bye.